I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, get ready for a perspective from south of the border, as Peruvian commentator and analyst Camilo Gomez joins us for a discussion of his work with the Center for a Stateless Society, an organization that describes itself as pro-market, but anti-capitalist, and has alternately been referred to as market anarchist-based or left libertarian. All that and more in the first portion of our conversation, and then a pivot to the topic of the protests in Chile, which Camilo recently covered for the Center for a Stateless Society in his piece, Chile and the Limits of Neoliberalism. Camilo fills us in on these protests and what they mean in the broader context of the growing global resistance to neoliberalism worldwide. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to the conversation with Camilo Gomez, author of the recent piece, Chile and the Limits of Neoliberalism for the Center for a Stateless Society. Welcome to Parallax Views. Camilo Gomez, freelance writer, an author at the Center for a Stateless Society, and host of the History and Politics podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm fine today. It's a sunny day now. It's summer in Peru.
Well, Camilo, maybe we could start out by giving a little bit of background about yourself, maybe for my listeners that may not be familiar with your writings at the Center for a Stateless Society, or you've also written for Counterpunch. Maybe you could give a little background for my listeners.
It's quite curious. When I became interested in politics, it was around 2013. I was a student in the National University of San Marcos here in Peru, which is the largest public university here. And I in Foucault and continental philosophy, but at the same time I was active in the local socialist party, and I started, you know, like, it was very curious moment, because it was a moment of protest, because we wanted to pass a resolution for the university reform, so a series of reforms to the university. So the popular election of representatives and things like that. So it was actually, while I was a member of the Socialist Party, it became much more of an activist moment. So it was kind of, there was a moment like there were marches every day, and it was really interesting. But at the same time, I feel that I don't have the parties, and most parties, not just the Socialist Party, but most parties on the left in Peru don't have the kind of, you know, like, ideological formation that they used to have in our time, where you were even not a militant from the beginning, but you were a pre-militant, and then it was approved your entrance to the party. But now it's much more flexible, because either people don't have time or are not really that interested. So, but at the same time, in my own, I was reading a lot about Michel Foucault and continental philosophy in general. And I get to a blog about an Argentinian philosopher. He's called Luis Diego Fernandez. And he was really interested in Foucault and also, you know, continental philosophy. But he also was interested by libertarianism. And until that point, I never have listened to libertarianism. And I remember reading one article he wrote about Garges. Garges was a very curious character. He was the speech writer for Barry Goldwater in 1964. But he, with time, he left the GOP and he became more or less anarchist. But he was a libertarian anarchist, so he was pro-market but anti-capitalist, which could sound a little bit weird. And when I started reading, it became kind of a little weird. And when I read one of his articles, The Death of Politics, I think at that moment I didn't knew that he was a libertarian, but I say, whatever Garges is, that this is when. And then I became much more interested in libertarianism. And I still became active active in the Socialist Party. I mean, most of the protests were more about social issues. I thought some were economic, but I think more or less all will have certain, will be support on both Marxist and libertarian grounds. Most of the protests, I think, I was a part of. What's the funny thing, but
I was gonna say, you're cutting out here and there. I don't know if you're not close enough to the mic. I didn't catch the author you were referring to that was got you interested in libertarianism.
Oh, it's Carl Hess. Yeah. Yeah, he was kind of the author that was my interest in libertarianism, and it was kind of I became much more interested in libertarianism, and while I see some things that were interesting in the electoral left, you know, I think it was more or less about when the left became like a fusion of all parties basically merged. And it was kind of weird to try to do some things, because I think when you're in a small party, but my positions weren't that much opposed, to be honest, which could sound weird. But I guess that it's because in Peru, it's a very informal economy. So the support for counter economics you know, like some form of agorism, to say in some way, it's not viewed as bad particularly. But I think that when most parties like merge into one. That was kind of, I think that then I feel that I didn't, that I wouldn't be able to do much in electoral politics. And I think that was when I left the Socialist Party, and I was more or less just a libertarian. And I think what with that time I was a left libertarian, but with the time I think I came to anarchism also. You know, like I there was a brief moment was a minarchist, a left wing minarchist, which sound kind of weird. But with the time, I also lack any confidence that the states will do anything in the long term. I think to a certain degree, I obviously prefer, you know, there is a debate on some left libertarians like to attack Bernie, but I think Bernie is obviously better than Trump. But to the degree that there are people that are too much invested in electoral politics, it's not longer my thing, I guess. And I was freelancing like since a long time ago, I think. I think 2015 was when I started freelancing, and in 2016 was something very weird. I was contacted by someone in the National Interest, and National Interest is a very curious publication. It's a publication that is founded by paleoconservatives, but I had been blogging, so they say, you know, like, we like your writing, so if you want to write something, you could write for us. And I actually wrote an article that was kind of funny because it says that basically Bernie Sanders' foreign policy is not socialist enough, and it was kind of funny that a publication founded by people that work with Nixon was arguing that Bernie was not socialist enough in foreign policy, but it's kind of the ironies of publications. And since then I have been freelancing and publishing different sites. And for a while also I was a libertarian foundation, for say in some way. I was kind of the most left-leaning in the libertarian foundation. It was Young Voices. And I think I should have written more about Latin America, because in that time it was easy to pitch the stories, but for different reasons I was reading more about the US. And I think I should have done the opposite, which is kind of what I am doing now, that I intend to write much more about Latin America and try to give a more of a left libertarian perspective on what, things that are happening in Latin America that I think not many are trying to give.
I just want to note, C4SS has been very fascinating to me over the years, because I think people have generally identified it as a libertarian organization, but I see so many parallels with the left, and I respect C4SS and people like Kevin Carson for really pushing back against Trumpism when a lot of libertarians have failed to do that, or even gone to the sort of political right and even alt-right pretty openly at this point.
And even Fortersome, I mean, like, for trans that have become literal Nazis, I mean, it's like Chris Campbell, the Nazi, the crying Nazi. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of that libertarian to alt-right pipeline. I think people like yourself, Kevin, the folks at C4SS, are much more on the left end of the spectrum. I often find myself agreeing with the analysis. It's very interesting because I think C4SS describes as a anti-capitalist but free market sort of thing. Maybe you could explain that a little bit. Is that your viewpoint?
Yeah, I think so. I think that that term involves many terms within the left libertarian broadly spectrum. I think that the general thing that I think defines left libertarians or market anarchists in general is left wing market anarchists is that we are opposed to the structures of corporate state capitalism. But we don't want to conflate markets and capitalism, and we think that markets work in a different way than what we have been told they work. And so I think one of my particular interests is counter economics. So in Peru there is a really interesting black market in basically everything. So Peru is one of the countries that has had more economic crisis in the world. I think probably Argentina has a little bit more. But Argentina, the difference between Argentina and Peru is that Argentina at one point was a rich country. But Peru, since the conquest, hasn't been rich in any capacity. So the amount of poverty that there is in Peru is very high. So buying things that were kind of taxed was very difficult in for a long time of Peruvian history. So there is people had still to buy and other things. So there is a lot of black market or things that go without taxes that don't go for the official entry in the country, and so the counterfeiting or the avoiding paying taxes or these kind of black and gray markets are really important for providing many elements of basic necessities. Sometimes even food that comes from by the border in Bolivia and other parts, and it's kind of a rebellion against a state, because in Peru the taxes are relatively high and the services are very poor. There is a historian, Alfonso Quiroz, who wrote a book about the history of corruption in Peru, and basically he was saying that since the founding of Peru, the 50% of the taxes the country has get from the population, it has ended up in corruption, so in the hands of several politicians and its cronies. So I think that in that regard, I mean, like, there is a very parallel market, and this kind of informality is like very very interesting, because like some people could say that, oh no, it's just people don't want to pay taxes and it's just but in reality I think much and a lot of this kind of markets are also built in solidarity. So for example, it's not that when people think about free market, the free market life, it's not that everything is on the market. For example, in Peru, one of the few institutions that works well is firefighters. And so firefighters don't get paid. They are just volunteers, but they are one of the few institutions that are respected. You know, like they volunteer their time and their work, and they are quite effective. Peru has, it has a very informal economy, so it's very common that people are, selling or living in places that are very old and, had bad electric facilities. So there are a lot of fires in a day. And generally are able to be able to save the fatalities that will be higher if they weren't there. So they are kind of show that it's not that the kind of clandestine or parallel economy generally is just a need or a desire to not pay taxes, but also that society organized in a very different way, and that does forms of solidarity work in a more useful way than government institutions.
I want to move on to your latest piece for C4SS, but just one more question in regards to libertarianism. If you could sum it up, maybe, what do you think the difference is between the sort of left libertarianism that you're interested in and the maybe right libertarianism, or the, I don't know, maybe even like the sort of Lou Rockwell sort of brand of libertarianism?
Yeah, I think that it's very funny, because I think that there are, I think, three groups of libertarianism. I will say that there is the right libertarianism that's generally more associated with Rothbard and with as you mentioned, Lou Rockwell, Rumble. And I think that kind of libertarianism has a lot of very proprietarian views. So a lot of this has to do with the vision of sacrality of private property. They kind of distorts everything. And for example, they have positions that are anti-libertarian, they oppose immigration, allegedly it's not immigrants' property, but it's contradictory, because at the end, the immigrant is not going to your home. It's going he could buy a home or whatever. No, but yeah, I think that it's very contradictory, that kind of tradition, that right libertarianism. But I think it has a life, because it's very associated with kind of the institutional far right, with the groups like Christian fundamentalists that are very anti-libertarian, particularly on social issues. I mean, and they exist, but I think that in this time, I think that Trump is going to create a new far right that is going to be much less friendly to the rhetoric of free markets and even of capitalism in some way, which could be weird to think about it, but I think that on the other hand, there is kind of this libertarian center that sometimes people call it right, because compared to Lou Rockwell or the Mises Institute or Hans Hermann Hoppe, they are certainly to their left, but I would say the libertarianism center is like the foundations and the organizations linked to the Kochs, to Charles Koch and Ed Koch, who were the founders of many, the Cato Institute, the Rizzo Magazine, and this kind of organizations. I will say they generally are much more pro-immigrant, although there are some exceptions there, but generally they are much more pro-immigrant. Generally, they don't, at least now, at least they don't use homophobic or explicitly sexist rhetoric. But I will say that there are many problems there too, because, for example, Tyler Cowen, who is a prominent libertarian economist, like the other way was interviewing an economist that has done and working comparative economics, and he was basically reciting the Charles Murray argument, basically the whole interview he was trying to push the Charles Murray argument, basically try to simplify development with the country we have having a larger white population, and it's very weird. So I think that even the libertarian center has some blind spots, and particularly around race, I think. It's where their blind spots are really clear. I would say that the left libertarians that I think are much more close related with at least I think the majority are, if not at least aware of C4SS or know people from C4SS, that we are around that orbit, think that obviously libertarianism is compatible, and it's not only compatible, but it's but positions like anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-homophobia, anti-xenophobia our values that we think are at the center of where we what it should do, and that free markets are not compatible with the amounts of hates and prejudices, that the free market is, the true free market is disruptive. It's not this kind of corporate state capitalism, when, you know, like big corporations get big handouts from the government. This is not a free market. This is a distortion completely of anything that should resemble a free market in a conception from our position.
Would you say that it's akin to what's been called like free market socialism or market anarchism?
I think that there are, it's interesting because I don't know that much about market socialists, to be honest. I know a little bit in the Peruvian sense, because like the government of Velasco Alvarado was very influenced by Yugoslavia. So in that sense, it's a current that really had some momentum at some point of Peruvian history. But now that I hear socialists, to be honest, some market socialists sound pretty close to left libertarians, which could sound surprising because at least some of the market socialists are Marxists. And I think that the left libertarians, particularly now, are not as in the past, they are not, we're in general, I don't guess we are Marxists, but I will say that it depends on the definitions. I think that if the definition of socialism is the workers owning the means of production, I think that definition, I think that a large swath of the left libertarians will agree in the regards that is the workers, not the state. So I think there are interesting developments in Latin America, like in our, a lot of workers have take over the factories. It's a really interesting development. Also in Brazil, the movement of those who don't land have been taking huge swaths of land around the country, and those are the kind of developments that could fit curiously in a Rothbardian framework, you know, the people taking back what the state has taken from them. And it's really interesting. I think that they're in the future is going to receive, I think, this more attention from the left. And I don't know if from the libertarians, because they're institutional framework is very different. Still, libertarians are have a very close relationship with the right, and even with Trump, that is kind of cutting the bridges. It's still difficult to see a moment when the institutional libertarian organizations are going to switch to left. But I think there are going to be individuals that, even if not necessarily left libertarians, are going to start making a lot of the arguments that we are making in some way.
Well, I think it's definitely an interesting phenomenon. I really hope people check out C4SS. I think if I'm going to be working with libertarians, I want to be working with people at C4SS, people like yourself. So I want to, extend the olive branch in that regard and tell people to check out C4SS. I do want to move on to your article on Chile, but I know you mentioned before we started recording that there's some things going on in Peru right now that you were interested in talking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a very curious thing going on in Peru. This Sunday, two workers died in a McDonald's. Apparently there was an electrocution, so they didn't have the normal implements, and they were mopping the floor without and there was some wire that was left there, and so they died of electrocution. It is still not clear at what exact moment, but the response from McDonald's have been quite confusing. It's not clear happened, and but beyond the thing that we know that they are dead. So a lot of the press is kind of covering this event, and it's kind of curious because I think it Peru is one of the countries that didn't went in the pink wave, that generally have much more conservative politics. But the media has been quite sympathetic to the dead workers in this story. I think that it has to do with two things. I think that the fact that the two workers, it was their first job. They both were very young. They were 18, have finished high school years ago and were young and that it was in McDonald's, which is kind of the symbol of global capitalism. And I think that is something that it's really going to it could become an element of discussion, you know, because like there is elections in January, and I think it's going to change the narrative, and I think it's going to favor the left, because the left is the only one that have been talking about labor conditions of workers, and workers are really, you know, in very bad conditions, many times in temporary work. I mean, they were temporary workers and they were working one day 12 hours a day. So it seems that it was a labor population because, like, technically, partial workers shouldn't work that long. It fits a pattern of how neoliberalism has, you know, in Peru, like, corporations have power and don't allow any kind of labor rights in any form or capacity.
Well, I think that's a good segue, actually, for your latest article, Chile and the Limits of Neoliberalism. We've been hearing a lot about Chile recently due to the protests. Maybe you could fill us in on what these protests are about for people that may be unfamiliar.
Yeah, so basically the protests were based on the Chilean government was going to increase the cost of the metro, and it was an increase of 30 pesos, which is some cents of dollar in exchange. But it was a group of high school girls that didn't want to pay and jump over the metro card, the machine that passed the metro card, and that started a revolt. So people for more than 50 years have been in the streets, and it has been a really interesting movement because it's a very grassroots movement. Chile has a very organized left, so there are a lot of parties in the left. There are more than 20 left-wing parties, and even anarchist groups are relatively well organized compared to other countries in Latin America where there are anarchists, but they're very, very vague. And it's very curious because none of the parties is literally leading this protest. It's much of a grassroots movement of people that were kind of tired of a system that has been arguing for the kind of status quo of the neoliberal reforms. And one of the things that should be mentioned is that Chile is a country that has had left-wing governments after Pinochet for many years. So it in reality is kind of a continuation of keeping of the things that haven't changed since the Pinochet government and the so-called market reforms. Because in reality, one of the greatest problems in Chile is the cost of living and the cost of education. So there are many things, but one of the things that is very curious is that Chile has higher the billionaires in Chile have more money than the billionaires in Germany, but the poor people in Chile live poorer than poor people in Mongolia. So it's very crazy because technically Chile is a medium income country going to become an upper income country, but the inequality that has led this status market reforms have become very, very patent in society. So for example, one of the main causes of protests is that, for example, the context was very, very important, because a lot of devs from corporations were forgiven. So it was kind of weird that they were going to increase the metro car that was going to be used by people that don't have car, obviously. So they are not rich and generally are much more middle class. So in that sense, it was kind of, you know, affecting the middle and the more working class elements of society, the kind of policies that Piñera, which the current president of Chile, who is a billionaire himself, was kind of promoting. And I think that the movement has been strong, and now they have gained some things, like the government has compromised to raise salaries, and now there is a possibility of a constitutional assembly to finally change the constitution, that because the actual constitution is the constitution that was written by Pinochet. So it seems that there are winds of change, but at the same time, the Chilean people are really rebelling. And to this day, there are people that have been protesting. So that are protesting, and there are many reasons. So one of the reasons is that the Chilean military, the first days, the Chilean military go out against the protests, and they acted very violently. There were many deaths. Then Piñera was forced to not call the military, and because the people were really angry, and it seems that taking the military, the protest is going to dissolve or calm down, but it didn't. And the police start to using more violent tactics, so they start shooting people, particularly people in the eyes. So a lot of people have lost sight, and in the graffitis in Chile, there are a lot of graffitis of eyes. And this was until recently. So recently, they have banned the kind of shooting that occurred before. But still, the people are protesting, because they kind of feel that the state is against them. So the Piñera called the protester like enemies, and even a military leader said that he doesn't consider people, Chilean citizens in the streets, as enemies. So it was kind of weird. I think that the Piñera government did everything wrong, and that was, which has led that this protest is much more massive than it would have been. Because at the end of the day, even if Chile has that much troubles, I think it is still not as poor as other parts of Latin America. But I think that the element that finally broke the kind of order that was in Chilean society was the form that the Chilean government reacted with, a very, you know, in a very violent form.
Well, the other thing to note is that even though poverty has fallen in Chile, I mean, medicines, as you know, are more expensive than in Denmark. Groceries are more expensive than in the Netherlands. The middle class is fragile in Chile. I mean, you know, a few bad months and, you know, that middle class status could be gone. So there are, like, real issues at work in all of this.
Yeah, that's true. So I think that's our elements that are really important. One of the things that is really important to know is that Chile was close to approve the TPP, which was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That would have actually risen even more the cost of medicines. And it was lucky that the deal wasn't passed, because it will have increased the cost of medicines and particularly some, it should be known that Chile is a very social conservative country. So, there is not much talk about sexual education. Actually, the HIV rates in Chile have been going up lately. So some of the TPP, included, regulation of patents for HIV, for drugs for people with HIV, and that will have generate a lot of problems. But actually, the Chilean government will back down. It was more or less the U.S. which finally didn't push for the TPP. But yes, groceries also are expensive in Chile. So basically, as a Peruvian, or basically any Latin American knows that Chile is expensive. And that is something that is very, yeah, it's very curious, because like people talk about competition and free markets, but the reality is that there are a lot of monopolies. So there are a very few large, the economy in Chile has been centralized in large supermarkets that control the market and push the prices to where they want. And that is something that I remember when sociologists in Peru said that a protest like the one in Chile in Peru will be difficult to see, because also one of the reasons, because there was protest also, is that when the first days of the revolt, of the social revolt started, there were some attacks at some supermarkets, and the country became like it was difficult, because like they depended on the supermarkets, and when supermarkets were attacked, people were angry. Yet not even the ones that were relatively well off became angry with the government, because like they were able to buy food, even in their food. So in that regard, I think that the kind of monopoly that there is in the food in Chile has created and generated a lot of anger, and that has led the rates of approval of Piñera are very small. So basically, I mean, even I'm sure, you know, at this point, even members of the upper middle class are opposing Piñera, because this kind of protest has altered the order there was in Chile, and as you mentioned, the issue of the middle class it has to do with the cost of medical expenses. So it's true that in some ways the healthcare system in Chile is a little bit better compared to other parts of Latin America. But the problem is that it's much more expensive. So, I mean, it's common that some Chileans actually travel to Peru to take care of them, because like in Chile the costs are too high. But not all live close to the border to Peru, and not all are in conditions of travel. So the ones that cannot do that have to do like in the US, like, is you know, collect money from friends and family in order to be able to afford the medical expenses that are quite high in the country, and that is one of the reasons that it's relatively easy to fall into poverty despite being in the middle class. I think that also happens in the U.S. So when medical bills are too high, that could let people having to sell their homes, and there are a lot of horror stories about things like that. So the other issue is education, which also looks a little bit like the U.S. So there are people that get a lot of debts in order to have education. The trouble is that the Chilean universities, with some exceptions, are not that high ranked. So there are one public university, the University of Chile, and another private university, the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile, which were well ranked, were well respected internationally, and considered among the best universities in Latin America. But the other universities are not necessarily that good, but still they're quite expensive. And when people finish their career, get their degree, and enter the labor market, they don't necessarily gain enough money, you know, have the salary to be able to pay their debts. So it became kind of a trap. So they cannot emerge from the position they are. So this kind of cases are very similar to America, but in a context where people have much less capital than the average American.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you note that the protests are much more than the violence of a few. There's people playing music, there's dancing, there's families going together to defy the police. There's also some colorful elements. And yet, you mentioned that the ruling class is terrified. I found it really telling that you note Panera's wife refers to the protesters as an alien invasion. And I think it's indicative of the widening chasm, the gap between the sort of haves and the have-nots, the ruling class and the rest in Chile. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I mean, Chile has a very strong, like, class distinction. So, it is, like, very, very clear in the ways that, for example, like, private education. So in Chile, there are three forms of education. One is like private education, the regular private education. The other one is charter schools, who are public but are privately managed, and there are public schools. So the middle class and the working class generally go either to charter or public schools, but the ruling class, as the from the upper middle class to up, they generally go to private schools. So from the beginning, since they are little child, they became part of a parallel society in some way. And that remains until, you know, like, and the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile, which is the private university, the most prestigious of the private universities, is where a lot of the Chilean bourgeoisie, the rich, and the upper middle class from go to study, and it has become very clear that this kind of elitist education is structural to the system being as vertical as it could be, and that I think it's very, it's quite common in Latin America in some ways. And I think that the difference a little bit with other countries in Latin America is that the Chilean millionaires and billionaires have more money than their counterparts in other parts of Latin America. So, for example, in Peru, many of the malls are owned by Chilean corporations, and a lot of companies are owned by Chilean corporations. So, there is a lot of Chilean investment in retail in Latin America. So in that regard, the generally the local bourgeoisie in each country in Latin America is based on people that make money inside their own country. But in Chile, it's people that make money in a regional way. So there are a lot of Chilean investments in Peru, but also in Argentina, in Bolivia. So Chile is an economic powerhouse in that regard. So that has led that there is kind of a distrust in Latin America for Chileans, that they consider Chileans as different in some ways. But I guess that with this protest, it has become a much more solidarity to what the Chilean working class is living, because obviously it's not the same, you know, the reality that the Chilean rich and you know, like the business class live, that, you know, the more working class reality, that it's very different. But yeah, I would say their bourgeoisie is even less in touch with reality than other bourgeoisies, than other ruling classes, because particularly the education division is much more clear in Chile than in other countries.
I think we can see a lot of parallels, as you mentioned, with the U.S. in some regards. One more thing I wanted to sort of probe briefly here is these problems in Chile, I think, arguably go back much further than recent memory. I mean, we can go all the way back to 1973 and the rise of Pinochet and the coup against Allende.
Yeah, I mean, Chile has been a pure society since then, and I think that kind of it's difficult to close the gap that became a divided society, It's still at war, even if now it's an ideological war, but it's still at war. One of the things that people don't talk that much is that actually there was a fascist movement in Chile. So probably if there wasn't a coup, there would have been, you know, terrorist attacks and violence. So it would have been bare in some way, but it would have been violent in some way, because the country was really fragmented in many ways, and it was a very curious, it's a very one of the most political divided countries, I think, in Latin America, Chile, because that could make partisanship in a very particular way. So it's very few countries where there is a right and left as defined as in the American sense as Chile, because like in Peru, there are parties all over the spectrum. And also that happens in Bolivia and Ecuador, but in Bolivia, in Chile, the difference is quite clear. So there is a very defined left and a very defined right. Now there are some, now the right is quite divided, and it maybe became much more divided because there are different forms of seeing this constitutional convention. There are some that are much more reformist. There are some that are much more radical. There are different kind of currents. There is an organization that comes from libertarian communists that now has a congresswoman, which kind of sounds weird, but it's the Chilean case is very particular, and their coalition is very unique. Their presence is very unique, and it's going to be interesting how the left can try to articulate the demands that these protests have brought to Chile in a near assembly, and then how they are going to be able to also push their voices in the next presidential elections.
And I guess in closing, what do you think the situation in Chile tells us about neoliberalism?
Yeah, it's going to be funny, but I'm going to say what I once read in a IMF paper. So the International Monetary Fund, you know, it's the boogeyman of the left, and I agree that a lot of the reforms have been very awful for Latin America, but sometimes the researchers there have written some things interesting. And one of the researchers actually wrote something that was really interesting. He wrote like a year ago, basically, that the kind of inequality that neoliberal reforms bring to Latin America was going to generate political instability. And this is what we are seeing in Chile. We have seen in Ecuador. And I think we're going to see this in many other parts of Latin America. Also in Ecuador, in Colombia, also we have seen much more recently. So, and neoliberal reforms had this very strong market rhetoric that the free market is going to work, but what they were saying is that this kind of market reforms, it's true that in some ways created reduced it to a certain degree. Some poverty in particular context. The trouble has been that these neoliberal reforms has also brought higher inequality. So there are people that have go out of poverty, but there are people that haven't, and they not only are even worse than they were before, but now they see a society where there are a lot of things, you know, there are you know, people that live much better than them, and that generates kind of a negative, toward that some injustice is being committed against them, and they are right, because like the kind of economy that it's happening now is basically a lot of corporate welfare. You know, like the Odebrecht scandal, who has been very important here in Latin America, has proved how, you know, like basically a lot of the story of the free market is really big. It was just that you know, like concessions were done, you know, in private form, just in order to be easier for the state to take money from politicians. I will say that these neoliberal reforms in the long term has brought much more inequality, and particularly now where you know, like the economy with Trump has, it's not as a lot of the income from Latin America is from primary resources, so like mining, gas. So these kind of resources are really important for Latin America. But their value is no longer as high as it was in other parts of recent history. And that has led that there is a feeling that the neoliberalism will no longer be the game in town now in some years. And I think that even in countries like Peru or Colombia, which in many ways have opposed the tendency of the so-called pink wave, you see that there are kind of some revolts. I will say that I also should have mentioned, you know, that these movements are intersectional in many ways. So in the Chilean case, there were also a lot of Mapuche flags to show solidarity with the Mapuche people who were also basically at war with the Chilean state. The Mapuche are the indigenous population of southern Chile, and they have been in a lot of conflict with the Chilean state. They have been, you know, killed, and to this day, they have a lot of conflicts toward the land in the southern region of Chile. Also, there is La Tesis, or The Thesis, which is this feminist collective that make their performance. And I think that these kind of movements are kind of intersectional. And also, in the Chilean protests, there were the presence of many LGBTQ collectives that were also protesting in favor of the rights of the gay rights. It's interesting, nonetheless, that in some cases there are conflicts. So, for example, in Bolivia, like some feminists and some celebrated the demise of Evo Morales, and indigenous groups were saying that they were racist, you know, to celebrate a coup d'etat. And so there are tensions, but I think it's still there is this question that there is more than just economics, that the kind of oppression is also a structural oppression, you know, not just the economic system, but the social system that in Latin America still is quite social conservative in general.
You know, I always like to end on a positive note. Do you think there's any possible positive note for maybe the future of Latin America in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, here in Peru, there is a very curious movement of high school students organizing themselves and protesting. And it's very curious because, like, since my high school students here in Peru are underage, so they are not, you know, a voting bloc, so politicians are not interested in them, but they are still are present in the protests, and they are trying to articulate a new kind of politics. And I think that is also happening in other parts of Latin America. The youth, the real youth, really young people are kind of moving toward, you know, a kind of decentralized politics, or a kind of, you know, of grassroots movement. And I think that going to be part of a much more, you know, a spontaneous kind of movement toward moving beyond neoliberalism and sexism and homophobia and xenophobia. I should have noticed that there some of the protests in Latin America there have been accusations that it has been Venezuelans, because a lot of Venezuelans have left their country in order to go nearby countries. So they have moved a lot to Colombia, or even to Peru or Ecuador or Chile. So they have been accused in many cases of being the ones behind the protests. But actually, I think the populations largely have, you know, opposed this conspiracy theory. And I think that has been a good sign that at least in the region, xenophobia is not as bad as in other places.
Well, Camilo Gomez, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views to discuss the situation in Latin America, and particularly Chile. Maybe you could tell my listeners how they can read your work, or maybe follow you on social media.
Yeah, they could follow me at Twitter. I am as Camilo Gomez, as Camilo MGN, as CamiloMGN. And that's where I that's the social media I use the most, and that's where I upload the podcasts I do or the articles I write.
Thank you, Camilo Gomez, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Camilo Gomez, and consider checking out his piece on the protests in Chile entitled Chile and the Limits of Neoliberalism. Let me know your thoughts about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at Views Parallax, or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Should be recording a video episode for my Patreons, which will also be available as audio for my non-Patreon supporters, with activist Sander Hicks on the Iran situation tomorrow on the 14th of January, and I'm going to be getting that out as soon as possible. The Iran situation is still fresh in everyone's minds, and things are still heating up in that region of the world, and in regards to Iran's relationship with the United States and our relationship with them. So, Sander Hicks will join us to discuss that issue. He has actually been in Iran, so he will be giving us his take and his insights on this ever-escalating situation. So, that to look forward to. Please consider supporting me if you can on Patreon. I really need it for the new year. Again, it's very much appreciated, all my Patreon supporters out there. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle.
new forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.